I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. An endlessly fascinating book is Robert McCrum's Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language. The book documents English's roots to where it is today, the world's lingua franca. It is the tongue of technology, ubiquitous on the internet, on our cellular phones, and elsewhere. 4 billion people have a functional knowledge of English. Robert McCrum joins me now. We'll talk to him about the book, some of the people responsible for the development of English over some 1,000 years, and where English, or Globish, is headed. Will it usurp or subsume our other languages? Will English be dumbed down? Where will technology take us, and how we communicate? Robert McCrum is the associate editor of The Observer. He was previously its literary editor. He is the author of Woodhouse, A Life, and My Year Off, Recovering Life After a Stroke. He lives in London, but joins me from Toronto today. He was a writer of The Story of English, its award-winning television series and book. Globish is published here in Canada by Doubleday. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Robert McCrum. Good morning, Mr. McCrum.
Good morning. It's nice to be on your program. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Let's begin with the anatomy of the word Globish. It's not your word, right?
It's not my word. It was invented, ironically, by a Frenchman, a man called Jean Paul Nerrier, in the 1990s. Monsieur Nerrier was a IBM executive who was posted to Japan, and he noticed in his time in Japan, he was an amateur linguist. He noticed that non-native speakers of English, Japanese non-native speakers speaking to, say, Koreans, non-native English speakers of English from Korea, say, or the Philippines, did better in conversation than they did when they spoke to Americans, Canadians, or English people. I.e., that there was something that worked better when the language was purely functional and there was no idiom. They got on better, and he observed this, and it's a very good observation. And in a moment of what I regard as sheer inspiration, christened it Globish, i.e., the world's, as you said in your introduction, the world's lingua franca, or everyone's second language. And I read about this in the early 2000s, and went to see him in Paris. He's subsequently developed this word with a program of vocabulary. And I went to see him in Paris and interviewed him for The Observer, which is a London newspaper. And we got on very well. And when I came to finish this book, which I was already commissioned to write, I thought, well, this is... Because I had, as you said, been involved or all responsible for The Story of English in 1985-6. And I'd always been looking to a way to develop the ideas of that, at the end of that book, into the present or the future. And so I began to write a book about the present state of English in the early 2000s, but Globish seemed to be a very good description for this phenomenon, as it were, the globalization of the English language. So I borrowed it from him with his full approval, I must say. And I think it's catching on. I think people are seeing that what I'm describing is something which they all recognize, and it's a phenomenon which has got, obviously, I think, quite a big future.
Now, is it a phenomenon that's only happened in the last, 25 years or so?
Well, I think so. I think my what I brought to this, my insight, so to speak, is that in the last 20, really since the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Soviet Union, the end of the Berlin Wall, so the last 20-something years, 21 years, English has become decoupled from, it's gone into a new phase. Before that, it was first associated with the British Empire and British colonialism, and then that was all during the 19th century. Then in the 20th century, very much associated with the Pax Americana and with what the French would call cultural imperialism. What I'm saying is that in the 21st century, there's a third phase, a Globish phase, where the language has become in some way detached from, decoupled from the awkwardness of the past. It's now a language, as it were, although I've described the past, without a past. It's a language which has its own momentum, a kind of supranational momentum, which is generated partly by global capitalism, the world economy, and partly by the IT revolution. And so people are now using English in a way that's much freer and much less associated with its history.
Now, I was born and I grew up here in Vancouver, right, in the early 80s, so right, just a couple of observations. First, it seems to me that this is all that I've known, that people have been speaking English, around the world. Second of all, when I was growing up in this part of the world, at least we were told that maybe we should learn something like Mandarin because it'd help our careers. Right. Nowadays, that's not the case anymore.
Right. Are your parents Chinese?
My parents are actually Filipino.
Filipinos.
Yeah.
Right.
So I've known Globish, I guess, my whole life.
And they came to Vancouver in?
In the 70s.
The 70s, right. Well, yeah. So you are a child of this development, in a sense, aren't you?
Right.
Or the beneficiary of it.
Yeah. So it just seems like it's been part of my life. And
well, I think that's right, and I think I think I'm describing something which everyone sort of instinctively recognizes, but I think I've given it a kind of conceptual framework, which is the framework, as I say, of the post of a period when, you know, the world enjoyed, before the Iraq War, 10 years of sort of blissful peace and booming economy, when the language really went into a new orbit. And there was, as you represent, a kind of new generation. But you're putting it a little bit earlier, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're saying it was the 80s.
Yeah.
Well, you may well be right. Of course, your experience is undeniable. But I think that take someone like the European Union. The European Union is very interesting because it was set up in the 50s as an Anglo-German-American union, and it was established in Brussels by statute that all the documentation that came out of Europe was in English and French, language of diplomacy, historically. And in the last 10 years, with the arrival of so-called accession states from the Eastern Bloc, former Eastern Bloc, you know, the former Hungary and so forth, these states are now using Globish in Europe on a colossal scale, and French has fallen by the wayside, so the English is now much more widespread in the European Union than it was 15 years ago. And so I'm partly putting your experience obviously relates to your time in Vancouver, but I think on a more global scale there is a switch or an accelerated evolution from the millennium onwards.
What does that mean though for other languages?
Well, people ask that question, and I don't think it has much impact on as it were the big ones. I think the ones that suffer are the smaller tongues. There was a story in the New York Times last week about how the Estonians are working very hard to sustain the Estonian language is a subset of Finnish, and it's really threatened, first of all, by the oppression by Russian speakers, and then now by the spread of English. And they've now introduced language police in Estonia to keep Estonian alive. And I think the small languages like Croatian and Dutch and Estonian, whether the small population base, and of course, in some Aboriginal or Native American tribes, there's obviously a threat of what's called language death. And I think that's a real problem. But I think it's comparatively small. It doesn't affect the Hispanics or the Arabs or the French or the Germans, honestly.
Well, the perception is that English is hard to learn. What do you make of English being the lingua franca? Yet it seems if you're learning Spanish or French, it's harder.
Well, I think it probably is hard to learn. I mean, you know, of course, a linguist would say that all languages are a Chomskyan linguist would say they're all neutral, they're sort of value-free, and whether the perception that they're hard or difficult to learn is really a perception. They're all the same. That wouldn't apply to Chinese, but I think it would apply to any language from the West. But I think the point about English is that it's good at being impure. It works well when it's impure. It doesn't have to be perfect. It still communicates meaning, even when it's sort of wrong. So it's very robust. It's very adaptable. It's contagious. People like to use it once they get the hang of it, even if in an imperfect way, it still works for them.
And popular culture has something to do with it as well?
I think so. I think, you know, I mean, certainly in the 20th century, movies, song, pop culture, advertising, all that has made and that's obviously an American phenomenon, has driven it around the world on a massive scale. But I think now, for example, take the World Cup. The World Cup is essentially, although there'll be many teams which are speaking their mother tongue to each other on the pitch, the World Cup is being played out essentially in Globish. There's a World Cup song which is written by a Canadian of Somalian origin, I believe. I forget his name, but the song is in English. or Glebisch, and the author of the song is somebody who's a Canadian with a very mixed background.
You opened the book by talking about some time that you spent in China, the Renmin University, is that what it's called? Yeah.
People's, in Beijing,
and
yes.
And you spent a Friday night there in the square, I guess, in the school?
Yep.
They speak English, right? And that's the purpose
of it. It's a very extraordinary scene. It's a little scene with which I start the book. And it's the point about it is it's repeated in Chinese universities all over China. And what you see is the young Chinese middle class, young men and women who want to get on in the world, practicing English. And they meet every Friday evening, and it's called English Corner. And they meet in the little square, in Beijing anyway, and they meet in this little square, and they rather self-consciously speak in English to each other. It's not an English which would be easily intelligible to someone like me, or an American or a Canadian, but when you spend a bit of time there, you get the hang of it. And they, of course, feel completely at home. They're using what they regard as the English language quite happily amongst themselves, and that's my point. Even imperfectly, it works perfectly well.
You break up the book by looking at, by five parts, where you look at the founders, the pioneers, the popularizers, the modernizers, and the globalizers. Barack Obama, you categorize him as a popularizer.
Well, Barack Obama is a very interesting case, and I've described him in various newspaper articles and as a globish president. And if you think of his origins, so born in Kansas. Of Kenyan, part Kenyan stock, who then goes to Hawaii and then later on Indonesia. His entire personal history is a globish history. If you read his book, which is a very good book, Dreams from My Father, you discover a writer who's versed in Shakespeare, the King James Bible, the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, but also the Quran and Indian mythology, Malayan mythology, Hawaiian mythology. Whole range of non-Anglo-Saxon, as it were, literary references, and also he's a good writer. And in fact, to go back to Jean-Paul Nerrier, who coined the term globish, and who now has this globish program, he has a program where he's campaigning for a fixed vocabulary, and he tried to translate, in one of his books, he tried to translate Obama's first inaugural address into globish, and you can't do it because Obama uses such a simple, although his ideas are quite complicated, his language is very simple. And you saw it during the campaign in phrases like, yes we can, and change we can believe in. These are very simple phrases, and using very basic English, which work universally. And he obviously understands language, has a good grasp of it, and he is, I think, a mirror for the current linguistic situation.
You also discuss in the book, and I read this part of the book with great interest, Churchill, and his use of language. Not since Alfred the Great, you write in the book, that has there been a British war leader who exploited the power of English and used it to galvanize his people and sustain his own victorious narrative, to quote from your book. Just how important was he to where we are today in globish?
Well, he said, he's somebody who, as I said, as you just said, he's acutely aware of English, and who also he gave a famous speech in 1947 at Fulton, Missouri, in America, where he talked about this is where he coined the phrase the Iron Curtain.
Right.
In the same speech, he also coined the phrase the special relationship between Britain, America, and the Commonwealth. And he was somebody who saw in the 40s after the Second World War, he saw the benefit of a global partnership between English-speaking peoples, and he wrote a history of the English-speaking peoples. Now that was obviously partly Canadian, partly Australian, partly South African, as well as English and American and Canadian. But he, as it were, laid down a grid for international harmony based on linguistic association.
At the beginning of the book, you also talk about Kieran Desai's The Inheritance of Loss. And I bring it up because we had her on for that book. That's a wonderful example of how I guess, I don't know if it's Globish or it's English, because the book is in English, how it's affected, I guess, books and movies and from India.
She's a very interesting case. I mean, to be honest with you, I haven't actually read the whole book myself, but I've read bits of it, and she herself, I mean, she's Indian descent, educated in New York, I believe, as a writer, and also with English connections as well. So she's got the trilingual experience, I would imagine that she herself is a. And I quote her because she won the Booker Prize in 2000 and something, and six, I think. And she's like, although she's writing in standard English in the novel, although the characters speak Indian English, and she represents that pretty freely. I think her heritage and her and the traditions that she draws on are, as it were, Globish traditions.
No, as
a mixture of all kinds of Englishness.
Right. Now you're an English speaker. You're a writer and editor as well. Are you anxious about English's future? Are you worried that Globish might dumb down English?
Not really, Joe. Because I think, you know, we're having a good conversation over the phone and on radio. And we're basically using standard English, either British or North American, which is essentially, I mean, allowing for accent is essentially the same. We're participating in a shared standard, which is of a fairly high, you know, not to flatter you or me, is of a fairly high standard of standardization. And I don't think, and if we were to have this exchange by email, it would be even more, there would be differences of spelling. But that would be all, and vocabulary. But it would be essentially the same, and it would be of a high educated standard, which works, you know, anywhere. And so that you have this standard, and you have, which is used by all educated people who are using English around the world. But at the same time, you can look at an oral culture, which is much more demotic, which is much rougher and less perfect, and so forth. I mean, the analogy I would draw is between going to a McDonald's to get a Big Mac, and saying, it's rather like, what your question is rather like saying, does McDonald's corrupt or dumb down international cuisine? Well, in one sense, it does. Yes, of course it does. But that doesn't stop people going to a three-star restaurant and having really good meals. You can still get aspire upwards to use a better standard, and you can enjoy a higher standard, and you can use it. You can read good books, and just because there is out there a means of communicating in Globish doesn't mean to say that the standard Anglo-American version is going to be dumbed down, honestly. So I'm fairly optimistic.
And it provides access to people that we wouldn't
it
be
does,
able to talk to.
Of course, going back to our Chinese friends who are in the English corner in Beijing, okay, 90% of them will speak a pretty rough form of English, and it'll be hard to understand for many people. But there'll be a small percentage, has always been true, there'll be a small percentage who are, and I've come across some of them in London and New York, who are, you know, highly educated, very well read, and speak, and more to the point, write it incredibly well, to a more remarkable degree. So I don't think it's a problem.
I guess we're reliant on where technology and advancements therein take us. Is that where we're headed for with Globish, right?
Yeah, I think, well, obviously, the story, this phenomenon derives, I think, from the kind of confluence of three very important strands. One is the, as I say, the end of the Cold War and the end of superpower conflict. Two is the global economy, and three is the IT revolution, which is, you know, the biggest paradigm shift in communication technology for 500 years. But I think those three come together, and they've made an extraordinary change.
Is it possible for you to foresee where we're headed?
I'm reluctant, Joe, and I'll tell you why. Because people in the past who have made predictions have almost always been proved wrong. But I think that when I finished doing the story of English, I'll answer this in a rather roundabout way. When I finished doing the story of English in 1986, the academic consensus, or there was a view amongst many academics, that English was headed for a split up. It was going to go the way of Latin. It would break up into mutually unintelligible varieties. And that hasn't happened in the last 20 years because, actually, globally has happened. There's been the forces which draw language together have been stronger than the forces which drive it apart. And so I think that, you know, if I cheerfully tell you now that I think globalism is the language of the future, I'm reluctant to say that because I think, you know, you never know. On the other hand, having said that, assuming that the world economy stays roughly the same, and obviously there's going to be a development from, there's going to be an influence from China, and that's bound to happen, but assuming the world economy stays roughly the same, and assuming the IT revolution continues on the path it's been on for the last 20, 10, 15 years, then I think Labour has got a very good future.
Robert, I've really enjoyed this book and our conversation today. Continued good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Joe.
You're very welcome. The book is called Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Robert McCrum, on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plantum.